You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Chad Harbach's novel, The Art of Fielding, was named one of 2011's best books by The New York Times and The New Yorker. It was The Leonard Lopate Show book club selection for June. It's set at a Midwestern college where Henry Scrimshander, a talented shortstop, has transformed the school's baseball team. But when a routine throw goes wildly off course, it upends the lives of five people. Mr. Harbach is the co-founder and editor of the magazine N Plus One. The paperback edition of the book is published by Back Bay Books. And I'm so glad to welcome Chad Harbach to the show. Hello, Chad.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is your first novel.
Yes.
Right? And it's an international sensation. It got great reviews, big bestseller, and I think most importantly, it was a Leonard Lopate Show book club selection. So let me ask you, does everyone just hate you now? Do you have a lot of former friends who can't stand your success? I just have to know how somebody in your position deals with this sort of thing.
Oh, well, it's an interesting question. Nobody says it to my face.
Okay.
I think most of my...
Well, trust me, they do.
I think most of my... They seem happy for me, at least when I see them, yeah.
Well, that's good when you see them. Well, you are not an overnight sensation. You worked for 10 years on this novel. What was... I'm just curious about your process, because that seems like a long time to stay interested in one book. Did you ever have a time along those 10 years where you were saying, what am I doing here? Is this? Am I ever going to finish this thing? Is this even worth finishing? Or do you have those dark moments of the soul?
Oh yeah, I had a lot of dark moments. Yeah, and especially, I mean, because you know when you've been working on something for 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, and you know the end still isn't in sight. Man, it's really desperate kind of situation.
And
you know?
People start sort of avoiding the topic at parties because they think, oh, there's Chad and his novel, you know.
Yeah, his quote-unquote novel, right? People, you know, it's like you cry wolf and people stop believing you after a while. I was really frustrated with myself a lot of this time. And, you know, and I kind of felt like, oh, maybe I'll work on this book for the rest of my life and just never get to the end of it. You know, I never really got sick of the book itself. I always really enjoyed working on it, and I always thought that it could and would be good if I ever got it done.
Mm-hmm.
I think threw up a lot of roadblocks in my own path, for one thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the original impetus for it? What idea did you start with?
Well, the very first glimmer of an idea was what happens to Henry Scrimshander in the book. And Henry's a great college shortstop who, just as he's on the verge of professional success, loses the ability to throw. This is something that has happened to some really good,
like Rick Ankiel like that,
and
yeah.
Chuck Knobloch from the Yankees.
He couldn't throw to first base.
He couldn't throw to first.
Didn't he throw the ball at Keith Olbermann's mom at one point in the stands? I'm pretty sure that happened.
Yeah, he hit her.
Yeah. Hit her. Yeah.
I don't think he did it on purpose.
No, he didn't throw it. No, she didn't have her glove. He just hit her in the head, I think.
And I was living in Boston at the time, and I went to some of those Red Sox Yankees games, and I would watch him warming up, and you could, even during warm-ups, he would just be, you could just tell that he was just terrified. And this was a guy who had been a Gold Glove second baseman.
Well, isn't it a thing in sports where you have muscle memory, and muscle memory is the thing that, you know, it's when you've had a repeated motion, you don't even have to think about what you're doing. And the problem for athletes is when their brain actually gets in the way of that and they start thinking about something that they shouldn't be thinking about? Or am I barking up the wrong tree?
No, exactly. I mean, they overthink. And I mean, because for a second baseman or a shortstop, like these guys, they've been making that throw since they were 7 or 8 years old. I mean, they're literally the best in the world at it. It is so easy for them. But then you start to overthink it. You start to, you know, contemplate like how many parts of your body are involved in this action. And you just all of a sudden make it seem overwhelmingly difficult to yourself.
And are you speaking from any experience? Are you an athlete yourself? Did you play baseball?
Yeah, I played growing up, but I was a pretty good high school player.
Mm-hmm. What position did you play?
I played shortstop.
Mm-hmm.
retired when I, you know, was 18 because I wasn't quite good enough to.
That's a sensible time to get out.
Yeah, I got out, but it was the first game that I learned, and I played it pretty seriously the whole time that I was growing up.
Now you invent this book within the book, The Art of Fielding, and it's by, I love this name, this Hall of Fame Cardinal shortstop named Aparicio Rodriguez, which sounds very real. And Henry, your protagonist, just reads this book over and over and over. It becomes so important. What can you describe the book a little bit and what it means to him?
Yeah, I mean, the book is it's a little book of 200 and some odd aphorisms that are, you know, one or two or three sentences long.
Are these sort of like Zen koans? Is that the thought of it? Or
yeah, I was thinking about Zen koans. There's another character in the book who loves like Marcus Aurelius, for instance. And so I was thinking about, you know, about Marcus Aurelius's writings and, you know, these little kind of sayings about how to live your life. And so the Aparicio's The Art of Fielding is, you know, ostensibly this book about how to play shortstop, but Henry also kind of goes into it for, you know, wisdom about how to try to live his life as well.
I'm Andy Borowitz sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Chad Harbach, the author of The Art of Fielding, which is a selection of the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club for June. Now, this is interesting. I feel that writers are really drawn to baseball to talk. Baseball seems to become a metaphor or at least a canvas for talking about the big issues of life. That doesn't seem to be true of, say, hockey or even, you know, basketball. I don't think that any other sport has attracted so much kind of metaphysical attention. Why do you think that is?
Two reasons, really, I think. You know, one is the long
the time we have to think about other things.
Well, that was the second thing I was going to say. First, I think it's just because it really, you know, because baseball was really the American game, you know,
right,
between like 1850 and 1950, it really does have this long association with American history. And so I think a lot of writers like to talk about the history of America in terms of baseball.
Right.
And also, like you say, I mean, because it is this kind of slow and pastoral game, I think it opens up a kind of space for reflection and thought that is a little harder to find in on a hockey rink. Although maybe writers should try harder, and maybe we should have, you know, some more great hockey novels.
Well, my first novel, The Art of Hockey, I will get into that, because not that I'm ripping you off or anything, but it just, I see it's worked out really,
you know,
well for
Don,
you.
Don DeLillo wrote under a pseudonym a hockey novel.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the book called?
You know? I think the book is called Amazons,
mm-hmm.
And his pseudonym was Cleo Birdwell, I think.
Wow. Well, now we can go online and see how those numbers are doing, whether everyone's suddenly buying Cleo Birdwell's books.
It's about the first professional female hockey player.
Oh, that's a good idea. Well, now I'm going to turn over this segment to your many readers, because since this has been a book club selection, a lot of our listeners have been reading and have questions to address to you. So are you game for that? Are you ready to just throw yourself into that?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Gene from New York asks, I'm guessing that Aparicio Rodriguez is a combination of great shortstops, Luis Aparicio, that's who I thought of from my childhood, who played for the Orioles in the 60s, and Alex Rodriguez, A-Rod. Am I right?
You are incorrect.
Sorry, Gene.
I could see how you would come to that conclusion. I mean, I certainly took the name from Luis Aparicio,
right?
You know, who was sort of before my time, but I just love the music of that name, and I just wanted to steal it. I think it's so beautiful. But in terms of Aparicio's career and the way that he plays, I was really thinking of Ozzie Smith.
The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz, mm-hmm. Who, even though, and I grew up a Brewers fan, and the Cardinals were our hated rivals, but even so, I always just thought that Ozzie Smith was the most beautiful baseball player that could ever possibly exist.
Yeah, amazing. He's your favorite shortstop. What about, do you like Omar Vizquel? Are you an Omar Vizquel fan? Or not particularly.
Not especially. Mm-hmm. Not especially.
Interesting.
I think he's a great shortstop, but a lot of people put him in the same category as the Wizard of Oz, and I think that is unwarranted.
Okay. Well, now the board will just light up with Omar Vizquel fans. How about Jeter? What do you think of Jeter? Now, I want to just create a little more controversy.
Jeter is it's amazing what he's still able to do at his advanced age, which is probably exactly like my advanced age.
Well, that was an extremely delicate response to that question, so I'll just move on. Let's see what other questions we've had. Okay, this is Charlotte from Port Washington, New York. What came first, baseball as the metaphor, the playful but serious allusions to Melville, who is often credited with having written the great American novel, boys trying to become men, when what it is to be a man is so complicated? Okay, so she has several things. These are, I guess, all layers. She wants to know what came first. I suspect that maybe some of them came at the same time. Baseball is a metaphor, many allusions to Melville, and manhood. What came first?
What came first?
Go.
Baseball came first.
Baseball always comes first, Charlotte.
You know, because, as I said before, I really started with this very particular baseball problem.
Right.
So I knew right away the book was going to be about baseball.
Don't you think in any story you have to start with the character in the story? You can't really. I think if you start with the theme, then aren't you getting into kind of a schematic? If you have a theme and say, okay, now I'm going to populate it with people and they're going to act out the theme, that seems like it would be more mechanical than just telling the story of this guy and then see what themes emerge.
Yeah. I don't think you necessarily think of theme at all when you're writing.
Right. Happens.
Yeah. There's, as you work, I think there's an intuitive way in which things fit together. And if you step back from that, you could say, well, because they both fit under this kind of common theme. But I think when you're actually working, I think you're always concentrated on very minute and specific things. And you're not really thinking about metaphor in a larger way either. You know, I think you're always just kind of focused on getting a very specific moment right.
Right. Well, here, let me ask you a question. We've touched on the big plot development, which is that he throws the ball and he accidentally hits his roommate and teammate Owen in the face, and that gives him this case of the yips. Is that, were you basing that just on the sports phenomenon that we discussed with people like Chuck Knobloch? Is it a well documented problem that if you have an accident like that, then it's going to mess with your mind?
It's not so. It's funny because I think it's sort of well known, but not very well documented. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really research it.
Right.
I sort of saw it happening as a fan, and I think I felt actually excited and liberated by the fact that very little had been written about.
Right.
It.
Right.
Very little. It hadn't been, and especially in the 10 years since I started the book, sports psychology has become a much bigger field than it even was then. But I felt like very little had been done on this subject, and that I just wanted to get inside the mind of someone to whom that was happening.
I'm speaking with Chad Harbach about his novel, The Art of Fielding. It's out in paperback from Back Bay Books. It's this month's pick for the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. And you can join the conversation by leaving a comment on our show page or giving us a call at 212-433-9692. That would be fun to take some calls. We'll have more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate here at WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm speaking to Chad Harbach, the author of the critically acclaimed bestseller, The Art of Fielding. It is a selection of the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club for June, so we're going to go to some of your questions about the book. Now, let me ask you a question, this is a plot issue, but it's probably one that is on the minds of a lot of our listeners who have read the book. So he throws the ball and he hits Owen in the face, his teammate, and then Owen is taken to the hospital, and this gives the school's president, and how do I pronounce the school's president's name? Gert?
His first name, Gwert.
Gwert. Mm-hmm. Gwert Athenlight. How did you? That's an unusual name. How did you come up with that name for him?
Affenlight. I just like the sound of it.
Yeah, it's a good name.
And Gwert, actually, that comes from kind of the play with Melville in the book,
right?
Because Gwert is an old Melville family name.
Right. So for those Melville fans out there, you saw me coming a mile away with that. So anyway, Gwert gets closer to him in the hospital, and he has a bit of a crush on him. What this is an interesting turn in a baseball novel, a sports novel. What made you think of developing this kind of sexual attraction between the two of them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think first, I talked about the way that the novel, began with baseball, but I think for me, from the very outset, I didn't really want to write a baseball novel.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't a lot of sports novels that I love. It just wouldn't have interested me to like spend all of the time that I was going to spend on this book, like thinking about baseball.
Right.
So I started with Henry and Mike, but I knew right off the bat that I wanted to, expand that central cast of characters to contain some people who just didn't care about baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Affenlight showed up as this the president of the college, this former English professor who goes to a game, but he's not there to see the game. And after that, things kind of happened fortuitously because I was writing along and asking myself, well, why did he go to the game? Well, he's there to see Owen, and why is he there to see Owen? And well, that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So Affenlight and his daughter Pella and Owen all just kind of came out of writing that one chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, this is an interesting group of people to kind of set against Henry and Mike, who are so serious and sometimes kind of self-serious about the game.
Right. Now, this is not really a question, but it's a comment from Beth in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. And she says, I love that Owen's sexuality, while driving a plot point, was not scandalizing or even the point of the whole thing. I love that your novel accepts homosexuality as a fact and builds the plot from there, as it should in real life. Now, that's a very nice comment, but it leads me to ask, have you gotten any comments, probably on Amazon, where most nasty comments seem to reside?
That's true.
Have you gotten any comments from, say, readers who really saw a book called The Art of Feeling and say, oh, good, finally a manly sports novel that I can read. I really like baseball. I really like sports. And then they stumble on the fact that there is a love story between two men in the book, and they're like, what is this? Have you gotten that kind of reaction from anybody? Or
I have. Yeah, I have. It sneaks, and because when the book came out, there was an excerpt of it in Sports Illustrated, which I think, attracted a lot of, manly men to the book.
Right.
And I think some of them were quite taken aback when they discovered all of the things that the book is about.
Does that kind of entertain you, or what's your feeling when you, get... I mean, they're really kind of responding viscerally in a way to the book, so I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I like to think that I've, this was a concern of mine, before, when I was writing the book, I didn't often think about, anyone ever publishing it while I was writing it. But if I ever did, I sort of thought, man, I'm writing this book that's about baseball on the one hand, and then it's about this gay relationship on the other hand. So like the two categories, these two groups of people who might possibly be interested in my book kind of just cancel each other out in a way. And so I was kind of worried about this from the outset. So I've been very gratified by how many people have been willing to kind of mesh those things in reading the book.
Now, Tom Parrott from New York City asks, he's asking a question about the fictional college Westish that you created in the book. It says, is Westish based on or a composite of any existing Wisconsin liberal arts school such as Beloit or Lawrence University, or is it entirely invented? He says, it's a pity none of them are on Lake Michigan. This is a guy who's very focused on the geographic aspects of the book.
Yeah, well, it's funny. Whenever I talk to people in Wisconsin about the book. I get asked that all the time, like, is it Beloit? Is it Lawrence? Is it, you know, is it whatever? And the small college that is closest geographically is a little Catholic school called St. Norbert, which is in kind of the right spot and where several members of my family actually went. But then the campus of Westish doesn't actually look like the campus of St. Norbert very much.
Okay, now I have a really rude question. Are you up for that?
Yeah, bring it on.
Okay, we'll see what kind of a man you really are, Mr. Chad Harbach. There was an article by B.R. Myers in last month's Atlantic magazine that called your novel the most overrated novel of the year. Wow. The writer's main point was that you're a publishing insider, and that benefited you. Well, first of all, and do you have a response? First of all, what is the nature of your publisher insiderdom? I want to know what that's all about. This N plus one, because you're the founder of N plus one.
Yeah, I'm one of the.
Explain what N plus one is for those who are not familiar with what access to power that gives you.
Oh man, so much power! You have no idea. N plus one is a magazine of literature and politics and culture, which comes out three times a year. And which I founded with four friends in 2004. And so, I mean, in the sense that I've, you know, lived in New York since 2004 and published this magazine, I guess I'm more...
You're like Rupert Murdoch.
I'm basically
Rupert. Tremendous power.
I don't like to say it that way, but you know, when you print
you probably have a website too, I would guess.
Well, when you print a magazine with a circulation of like 10,000, it
goes to your head.
It goes to your head, yeah. But in fact, when it came time to send out my book, like I didn't even really know. I didn't even know who to send it to. I didn't know the names of agents or anything like that. So, I mean, my insideriness is probably much more than some people's, but it could easily be overrated itself.
Well, I know very few novelists who wouldn't want to write the most overrated novel of the year. That seems like that means that you've been rated very highly by a lot of people. So enjoy that, your overratedness while it lasts.
I think that's pretty great.
And Anne has this question. I love how mean when anybody is a success, somebody has to find the terrible thing about it. You're overrated now. Anne has this question. The book was so easy and captivating to read, but probably not to write. That's true. Was the story pre-mapped? Were the characters fully conceived from the start? Thank you for a wonderful Midwestern tale. I'm from Iowa. Now, you've indicated, I guess, that the story wasn't pre-mapped, that you sat down with this basic idea and then certain characters took over. Is that the way you work? I guess it's your only novel, so I guess is that the way this worked out for you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I had the five characters and the setting kind of well in place very early on, but the plot evolved very, very slowly as I was working on it. I had a couple moments in mind. I won't give it all away, but there's a moment about maybe 60% of the way through the book when Henry walks off the field during a game. And that was a moment that I had conceived of very early. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I was going to, by hook or by crook, kind of
land on
get the book there.
Right.
So I think it's, you know, I think there's a way in which you want to have these mileposts as you work. But if you know, I think if you know too much going into it, it's boring to write.
Yeah, you're just filling in the lines. This is Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lope today, WNYC, WNYC.org, and I'm talking to Chad Harbach, the author of The Art of Fielding. Okay, here's another question. Deborah asks, what authors do you like or have influenced you? Wonder particularly about John Irving. Couldn't help but be reminded of A Prayer for Owen Meany and The Throw That Went Awry. I have not read A Prayer for Owen Meany, so I can't address that, but I'm sure. Have you read that?
No, I have not. But it is. I mean, that is the that's the comparison that I've heard most frequently. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have, and as I have since learned, the very first pages of A Prayer for Owen Meany, of course, there's a character named Owen, as
right.
in my book, and in the very first pages of that book, a character is killed by a ball at a baseball game.
It sounds like you just rewrote the exact same book. I mean, it's uncanny. Now, so that when you found out that, was that like, holy cow, that's a weird coincidence.
Yeah, and you know, and if I had known that, I don't think I would have. I would have changed Owen's name.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't have
find replace.
It was it was just a sort of coincidence that I wouldn't have let happen.
Right,
you know.
Now there was while we're on this topic, there was I guess a Broadway play a few years ago called "Take Me Out" about baseball and a gay baseball player. Did that came out while you were writing the book? Did you hear about that and say, "Oh my God, this is going to be too close to my territory"? Did you just say, or did you not hear about it? Or
this is the first I've heard.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh really? Well, it's kind of a cross between that and I would say A Prayer for Owen Meany. They're kind of all the same.
Which you've never read.
Which I've never read. Well, there was a play, but you know, again, there are only so many stories in the world. So I guess that the fact that has never come up in any of the reviews means it probably wasn't that similar, because based on this guy who calls this the most overrated book of the year, they'd be looking for things to say nasty about it. So I guess not. Here is a question from Nancy Willick from Teaneck, New Jersey. She would like to know if you meant the surnames to be farcical, and if so, how. So many of the names, starting with Westish, were compound syllables, vaguely reminiscent of the German, that didn't always feel quite well, believable, but I think she just means exaggerated. She's referring to names like Flox, Lunsdorf, Quisp, Scrimshander. Kind of a Melville quality to some of this, I guess. Are names important to characters, personalities, and moods? Well, the answer to that, of course, is yes. But why did you choose such an interesting collection of names?
Yeah, well, I think you're exactly right in that I kind of a couple of the names are sort of explicitly Melvillian, like Scrimshander.
Scrimshander, yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, and Scrimshaw is the art of whalebone carving.
Right.
So I liked both that word very much, and then I liked the fact that a Scrimshander is a kind of artist, the way that I think that Henry is a kind of artist. So a couple of them are explicitly Melvillian, and I think I wanted a lot of the others to have a kind of Melvillian, kind of Moby Dick-like kind of cadence to them.
Right.
Because I think that Moby Dick has some very specific and very beautiful musical cadences to it. And not that I could ever match those, but I think I had those on my mind a lot as I was writing.
And where did that, you know, it plays such a, Melville and Moby Dick play such a big role. Where did that inspiration come from? When you're, at what point of your process did you say, I really want to make this whole Melville thing a big kind of undercurrent of the book?
I think it was there really early, such that I can't really remember the origin of it exactly. I love Melville for one thing, and I also just felt like in a very basic way there was a sports team, a baseball team, is kind of the modern version of the whaling ship in Moby Dick, where you just have a group of dudes who come from all over, might not have that much in common, but they're thrown together and forced to spend a lot of time together in pursuit of this common goal. And so I just thought that I could, if I was able to do it in a sort of lighthearted way, I could kind of play with that analogy throughout the book, and that it would be fun for me and hopefully fun for the reader too.
Okay, here's a comment and a question from Bernie from Bloomingburg. And you're going to like this because it's very complimentary. I just had to tee that up for you, unlike that overrated one. While the five main characters are exquisitely drawn, notice that exquisitely drawn, what amazed me about the novel is the richness of the peripheral characters. Owen's mom, Henry's father, Pella's husband, Chef Spiridocus, is that how it's pronounced? Mm-hmm. Okay. And Aparicio Rodriguez all seem worthy of a story of their own. In the 10-year development of the novel, did any of these or other characters beg for a larger role? Who do you think has the richest story to tell?
Oh, man. I'm not sure. I mean, I think the fun of, at least for me, like minor characters are different from major characters in the writing. And you know, because the major characters like really exist in your head as people, and they you know, and after I'd been working on this book for 4 or 5 years, all those five main characters felt, you know, more real to me than the people I actually knew, because I spent a lot more time with them than I spent with the people I knew.
Right.
Whereas these minor characters that you mention, they're often coming into the book without a lot of forethought, because they serve a purpose. So you have a scene, and you need somebody and the person shows up and you just kind of write out of the need of the scene or the plot at that time. And then that person kind of takes on characteristics as you write. So you're not kind of going back through their history and developing their psychology.
It's a snowball effect.
Yeah. And that could be like, and sometimes you get more believable people out of that process than you do about thinking about their motivations and things like that.
Well, I've been speaking with Chad Harbach about his novel, The Art of Fielding. It's out in paperback from Bayback Books. It's this month's pick for the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. Chad, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Cool.